Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, March 11th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, we're bringing you a segment of our most recent Off the Hill political panel, which took place on Thursday, March 10th, on the theme In the Extreme. Co-hosting the event was former NDP Deputy Leader and House Leader Libby Davies and founder of the 613-819 Black Hub, Robin Brown. Our special guests included MP Leah Gazan, author Seth Klein, Rabble columnist Shuka Ijekam, and Rabble's own national senior politics reporter Carl Nirenberg. In the weeks prior to the event, we asked you what you wanted our panelists to tackle this time around, and you delivered. This month, our panelists discussed all of your top-of-mind topics, including the recently released IPCC report, Russia's war on Ukraine, and the visible rise in right-wing populism. As always, it was a spirited panel. Here's a snippet of that event. Take a listen.
As progressives, as activists, local and national, on and off the hill, where should people focus their energy to carve a way forward for real security based on peace, climate, and economic justice? Let's start with Sam.
It's an impossible question. There's so much going on. And a lot of good points that have been made. First of all, there's so many things happening that we can pick up that we need to seize and try to redirect. Chuka was rightly pointing out this wild double standard in the response to refugees. And yet I would also say that at the root of a lot of the response, notwithstanding the double standard, is this human instinct people have for compassion and solidarity. And now we have to redirect it. We have to kind of recognize it and say, as Chuka was saying, it's going to get worse, folks. In a climate changing world like we're heading into, the global movement of people is going to be one of the defining issues of the next 50 years. And are we now ready to respond to that crisis with a similar level of compassion and understanding? To segue from that and try to more directly answer your question, I think what the IPCC report clearly showed is that the climate crisis is the preeminent civilizational threat of our time. Although if nuclear weapons come up in this war, that's a pretty close second. But what the IPCC report said is that in excess of 3.3 billion people are at high risk and vulnerable to climate impacts. Already, climate change that's a sizable share of humanity, primarily in the global south, but we are not exempt from it either, as those of us in British Columbia know from last year. We lost 600 people in a week last June in British Columbia, mostly lower income seniors in the heat dome. We know that already with climate change, it is displacing in the order of 20 million people a year, mainly internally displacing them, and where the poorest countries carry the greatest burden of handling that displacement. So this is the real security threat. And what both the war and the IPCC report are telling us is that we have to hasten the day when we are done with these toxic products, these fossil fuel products, and we need to quickly pivot and act with urgency on that threat. It's also the case, and this speaks to Leah's point, both the pandemic and now this war are producing record profits You know, to the retailers in the pandemic, and now the oil and gas companies are making just as many, you know, households are struggling with high gas prices. They're making a killing. We need to tax that and put it to work in expediting the just transition before us. And you know, what I take primarily from Leah's point, whatever the policy form is, whether it's guaranteed income or guaranteed jobs, the point is the inequality that we experience and what that was heightened in this pandemic is toxic to the social solidarity that's needed when you're asking people to undertake in a society-wide mobilization like we now have to do. And so we have to tackle these things together.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Seth. Leah, just repeat it just so folks remember we're asking. Where should people focus their energy to carve a way forward for real security based on peace, climate, and economic justice?
Well, similar to what Seth mentioned, like, I don't think there's one focus. I think there's multiple things to focus on right now. And I think there are certain common threads. Growing inequality. When I was running for the nomination and then eventually the representative for Winnipeg Center, I spoke about a growing corporate dictatorship. And I wasn't sugarcoating it. And some people said, oh, Leah, do you think that's harsh? Like, should you use terms like corporate dictatorship? And here we see in the Ukraine, the threat, just terrible destruction, but also the threat of a nuclear war. You know, Carl, I share your concern about that. I grew up with a father who was a peace activist who lost a job, a teaching job, because he refused to take off his peace button. I grew up in a family that was very actively engaged in the peace movement. And the topic of the day, even in Russia, at the verge of a potential nuclear war, what are they talking about? The petrostate, the reliance on fossil fuels. And in the midst of all of it, we see growing inequality. And so how do you address that? I think you address it boots on the ground. I think you address it in government. I think you address it in academia. I think you address it door to door. I think, you know, this misinformation campaign, I know Trump coined the term pretty much fake news, but really fake news, to make sure that people are really getting proper information so that we have a clear direction to build a peaceful society that really honors equality, because you can never have peace in the absence of justice, whether it's like climate justice, human rights. There will never be peace in the absence of justice. And that's ensuring people have their human rights met. That means the right to live with dignity, the right to live in a clean, healthy, and safe environment, free of violence, with all their human rights respected, including enough to live in dignity and a roof over their head. Then you can have a peaceful society. But there's so much injustice and on overarching from what I feel is a growing corporate dictatorship that we need to go after the ultra wealthy. We need to tax them. And we need to change the way things are done, not just in Canada, but globally, to protect people above corporations, to protect our planet and our Mother Earth above the privileges and rights that corporations seem to be benefiting from.
Leah, Chuka and Carl, we're going to give you both a chance to answer this one. So, but keep it brief because we want to get to audience questions. But so Chuka first, where should people focus their energy to carve out a way forward for real security based on peace, climate, and economic justice? You're on mute there.
I similarly, I don't know that I can I can suggest what people should focus their attention on. But I think the thing that is sort of continually circling in my mind is that the only thing that matters is protecting and providing for everybody. Everything else is window dressing. And I mean, this is part, Carl, this is part of why I especially appreciated your intervention on discussion of nuclear war, because it seems that there isn't a recognition that that's just simply cannot be allowed. You know, the idea that it would be discussed at all is simply demonstrates how far we've gone past any point of reasonable existence, I guess, coexistence. And so lastly I'll say that I think Leah, your description of the present events as a corporate dictatorship is perfectly accurate, exact. It's if you take food from a supermarket without paying, you're breaking the law. If a supermarket throws away unsold food while people go hungry, it isn't breaking the law. The law clearly does not serve people.
Thank you, Chicken. Carl, over to you.
So I'm going to come down and say that my concern with the environmental movement, and it was a similar concern way, way, way back many decades ago with the peace movement, is that too many working class people and poor people see it as a middle class, privileged, entitled. They see it as, you know, people who can eat their more expensive organic stuff, and who can afford to recycle, and who can afford the electric car or whatever. And unless we really, we're not going to, you know, in the case, we had a similar problem in the pandemic. Sorry to switch here, but where the war against the virus was fought mostly on the backs of the least privileged and the poorer people, it was a failure, and it created part of the backlash that we experienced in the occupation of Ottawa. And my fear is that we have to find a way, much more than I think we entirely have to this date, to really, in a way, I think we have to put social justice and creating a far greater equal and far more equal society first, in order to make the war that we have to wage, the peaceful war that we have to wage against climate change, possible. If we don't, I don't think it's possible. I don't think you can have, I think it'll just result in all kinds of dangerous backlash, which is then picked up by the populist right, which then becomes fuel and fodder for the populist right. And by the way, we didn't even talk about the fact that the war in Ukraine is now putting enormous pressure on Canada to vastly increase its military spending, which is, like, normally speaking, it's the most wasteful kind of spending from an economic point of view. I'm leaving it hanging in midair there because there's too many subjects, too many strands.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Robin, before we go to the audience questions, I'm just wondering if Seth, I saw you kind of like leaning in and as though you wanted to respond to what Carl was saying about, you know, what comes first, what comes second. Yeah, any quick response to that?
I guess I balked at the first part. I think, the argument I've been trying to make is you marry the two, we've got to do them together. And that's when the magic happens. I mean, when you look at something like, and I share the same critique as you, Carl, of those climate activists who say, oh, don't link this to tackling social injustice and inequality, you know, don't weigh it down, make it more complicated. I think they're wrong. We have to link these. But when you do, it's incredibly popular. I mean, when you see this in the polling in reply to something like the Green New Deal, when you present a definition of the Green New Deal and you link bold action tackling the climate crisis with bold action tackling inequality and offering a genuine and hopeful jobs plan, the combined attractiveness of the two sends the popularity through the roof. And that's what's been missing, right? I mean, the federal climate plans to date, they've offered nothing on just transition yet and the connection with inequality.
Thank you. So now we'll take some audience questions. One's come in that says, basically says that they're loving everything you guys are saying and saying, why are our federal leaders not reflecting this? They don't see them reflecting this. What can we do to change that? Anybody want to take that one?
I'll just say quickly that federal politics, electoral politics, is a game of winning power or winning winning seats in parliament. So a lot of it, all federal leaders, including the leader of the NDP, they're always looking at where are the votes and what are their concerns a week from now, a month from now, 6 months from now, at the most 2 years from now. And it's very difficult to lead a practical political campaign based on the expectations for the planet and what we have to do for the planet for generations to come. So I think that is the great crisis for federal leaders. You also have to break down whatever you're proposing into a series of tangible, bite-sized, rhetorical little packages. And again, I worry that too much of what's happening can be fodder for the right and the extreme right these days, as much as for progressives. And I think that is going to be a big challenge. But I do think that some, you know, I mean, I would give Jagmeet Singh and the NDP some credit for making an effort to link together these issues. And I think the various provincial governments come and go on this, and provincial parties come and go on these issues. But you know, when you're running for office, you're very acutely aware of the voter who's got to get up in the morning and earn a living and wonder what you're going to do for them tomorrow.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah.
Just because I'm in the eye of the storm, the colonial storm here.
Yes.
But I would say there's a truth to that, Carl, but I do think that there's a new kind of politic emerging. I don't actually get up every morning and have calculations about how to win the next election. I actually get up every morning on a set of values and a set of principles that I promise to my constituents and fight for a better world. I've taken some pretty bold stands since being elected. I know that, the world's on fire right now, that there's, you know, really intense growing inequality, that there is wars brewing all around the world. And I think I share that kind of conviction along with several other colleagues. So I think there's a disillusionment and distrust in politicians, and I think it's well-earned. And, I think we need to change that. And I think that, you know, we need to base our decisions based on boots on the ground. You know, I was elected, I've said it many times before, I was elected, funded, put in power by the movement. I don't think people should forget who keeps us in and who doesn't keep us in, and that's the movement. And so I call out to the movement to keep our feet to the fire and make sure we're doing the right things. I know that guides my decisions.
Can I just point out too, while it's true that there are lots of politicians out there who default to a very cautionary place, it is notable that those politicians, like Leah, like Libby when she was in the game, who do speak boldly, keep getting rewarded with some of the largest political margins in the country.
Yes, indeed.
I was going to say, I don't have the deep political experience of the rest of you, but I do think that one thing that that sort of reinforces what you were talking about, Carl, is, and again, you know, I'm interested in your perspective on this, but it seems that one thing that reinforces it is the political reporting that largely occurs, you know, what questions do reporters ask and to whom do they ask them? If somebody proposes a universal basic income, if somebody asserts that like no one will go hungry, they'll get asked by reporters, well, how are you going to pay for that? You know, but if people talk about, you know, if I'm sure if someone argued for a maximum wage or a maximum wealth, 100% income tax past a certain level, it would be sort of called a wild-eyed communist, you know, and more power to them for being so, but still, it would be called that. Whereas politicians aren't questioned why it's acceptable that there are billionaires and poverty, right? Like the fact that this is the circumstance of our existence, politicians aren't asked to justify it, but whenever they want to pursue radical action to pursue justice, then they are asked to justify that. And so I do think there's kind of a reinforcement mechanism that quells earnest radical actors.
Carl, we don't want to put you in the eye of the storm as the reporter, but any thoughts that you want to add to that?
Well, you know, I just wrote a note. I said, you know, I've always found that political reporting, as has been done forever, is too much like sports reporting. It's appropriate to treat hockey as a game. It is a game. It's also a business, but it is a game. In the final analysis, whoever you root for, your life won't change if your team loses. You know, my team, the Montreal Canadiens, have never done worse. Life will, you know, it's a momentary disappointment, but it doesn't matter. I mean, I wish I could tell my colleagues in the political reporting game, the people, when you, and the politicians often too, the participants in politics aren't merely the politicians, they're all of us. We're all participants. And the issues and the policies are as important as the ups and downs and personalities and who's going to win and who's ahead in the polls and what's going to happen. You listen to so much commentary, and honestly, you could substitute a few words and you'd think they were talking about a hockey game and not about an election or about politics. It's so similar. And there's a lot of the people involved in professional political reporting are big sports fans, by the way. There's a big overlap. Some of them should have gone into sports reporting, I suppose, and really like that better. But, you know, treating it like a game and treating it like who's up, who's down. And whenever when we get reporting, we always turn it into this. We rarely hear somebody report on a leader making a speech or proposing a policy and then discussing that in terms of its value or its impact or its worth. It's always, well, what impact will that have on this person's popularity? Will they win more seats that way? What do polls tell us? How are they likely to make that work in the political game? It is a frightening degree, and it's often.
That was a clip from our latest live politics panel, which took place on Thursday, March 10th. Thanks to all who tuned in and to our wonderful guests for their insight. If you missed last night's event and would have liked to attend, you can always catch us next time. Our next Off the Hill event will take place Thursday, April 14th, 2022. Ahead of the April panel, don't forget to register so you can have your chance to interact with our panelists through questions, polls, and more. Keep up to date by signing up to Rabble's free weekly newsletter at rabble.ca/alerts. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. This week on the site, Rabble writers examine the possibility of nuclear war as Russia's invasion of Ukraine reaches a breaking point. Carl Nirenberg breaks down Michael Ignatieff's recent Globe and Mail piece. Ignatieff is, in essence, proposing NATO should, if push came to shove, strike first with the catastrophic and deadly force of nuclear bombs and missiles. The use of nuclear weapons, which Ignatieff is willing to contemplate, would almost certainly become an all-out nuclear war, Nirenberg writes. Using nuclear weapons would not bring victory. It would bring global catastrophe. Nirenberg reports that the Doomsday Clock, which shows how close humanity stands to full-scale nuclear war at any given moment, currently sits at 100 seconds to midnight. Brent Patterson argues the war in Ukraine should lead to climate action, not climate destruction. He refers to the work of Svetlana Kurkovska, Ukraine's leading climate scientist, who draws parallels between climate change and the war, explaining, "It's clear that the roots of both these threats to humanity are found in fossil fuels." Kurkovska further comments, "Burning oil, gas, and coal is causing warming and impacts we need to adapt to. And Russia sells these resources and uses the money to buy weapons. This is a fossil fuel war." But Prime Minister Justin Trudeau isn't up for rapid decarbonization. Instead, he's announced Canada will soon be deploying 6 CF-18 fighter jets to Romania. Conservative National Defense critic Carrie Lynn Fenley says Canada still needs to do more and buy F-35s. Both warplane options are carbon-intensive and extremely expensive, costing an estimated $76.8 billion over their lifespan. This is money that could otherwise be used to finance a just transition away from fossil fuels, Patterson argues. Canadian F-35s are years away, while unarmed civilian resistance in Ukraine is providing inspiring examples of action happening right now. Now is the time to back that resistance with globally coordinated climate action. Also on the site this week, March 8th was International Women's Day. We kicked off coverage with a feature report by Stephen Wenzel on the experiences of incarcerated mothers in Nova Scotia. Wenzel interviewed co-author of the recently released Maternal Incarceration in a Provincial Prison in Canada, who says this report is the first of its kind and outlines 7 recommendations for change that focus on providing alternatives to incarceration for mothers experiencing criminalization, with hopes of impacting sentencing and incarceration practices. Martha Friendly of childcarecanada.org writes on why women need to keep advocating for universal childcare, noting that the previous federal budget announced in April of last year promised a feminist intersectional action plan for women that will work to push past systemic barriers and inequities for good, with universal childcare at the top of the list. This was obviously something to celebrate this International Women's Day, but the work doesn't stop there. What is needed next is a period of focused transformational system building, explains Friendly. Building a quality childcare system for all is a big, complex, and multifaceted task. It's being called a journey, not a marathon. And finally, Kathy Crowe discredits the Housing First model implemented by federal, provincial, and municipal governments. She says it's worsening Canada's homelessness crisis. The Housing First model, Crowe argues, coincides with other neoliberal policies that brought us the problems we're experiencing today. Cut services, they're inefficient. Cut supports, they're too expensive. Eliminate shelters, they're a blight on the neighborhood, she writes. Provide cheap housing instead, the argument goes, at the expense of shelters and programs that provide support. She concludes, not only did Housing First become the tool to justify economic policies that ensured further withdrawal of life-saving aid such as shelters, but it also smothered advocacy and critical thinking. You can catch all of those stories and much more on rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Stephen Wenzel and Carl Nirenberg for their reporting this week, and Carl, too, for supplying the music. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.